Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Samuel David Luzzatto, known by his Hebrew acronym Shadal, was the leading Italian Jewish scholar of the 19th century. A linguist, educator, and religious thinker, he devoted his talents above all to the interpretation of the Bible. As a master of Hebrew grammar and usage, he focused on the plain meaning of the text. Although he was a devout believer in the divinity, unity, and antiquity of the Torah, Shadal approached the text in a remarkably free spirit of inquiry, drawing upon a wide variety of sources, ancient and contemporary, Jewish and non-Jewish. As a result, his interpretations may strike even the modern reader as fresh and novel. Here, for the first time, is an all-English version of both the text translation and the unabridged commentary. Through Kodesh Press, Daniel Klein has translated Shadal's commentaries on Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus. Join us as we speak with Daniel Klein about Luzzatto's life and commentaries on the Torah. You're listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm Michael Morales, your host. Daniel A. Klein is an attorney and legal writer and a graduate of Yeshiva University and New York University School of Law. His study of Italian as a youthful hobby led to a fascination with Italian Jewish culture, and in particular, the works of Shadal, Samuel David Luzzatto. He and his wife live in Rochester, New York, where he has taught Judaic studies at elementary, high school, and adult levels. Dan, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So Dan, tell us a little bit about yourself as we begin.
Right. Well, my name is Daniel Abraham Klein. I'm 67 years old. I have worked most of my professional life as a legal writer and editor. I got my undergraduate degree at Yeshiva University in New York. Then I went to NYU School of Law. Until really recently, I never actually practiced law. I was in the legal publishing industry, writing articles about topics of law, editing other people's work. Now that I'm a little bit retired, I'm working for an actual law firm doing actual law work. And so now I can actually say I'm a lawyer. I grew up in Yonkers, New York, so just north of New York City. I now live, well, for about half my life in Rochester, New York, where I got a job. We like living upstate. I've always been interested in languages, and that's something that I can talk about a little bit more about how I got into Shadal.
Dan, you've been translating Luzzatto's works for some decades now. What was it that first drew you to him?
Well, it's a long, complicated story, but a kind of a cute one. Let's begin with my father, who was a world traveler in his business. He spent a lot of time in Europe and felt very strongly that he should try to communicate with people in their own languages. He went to Berlitz and took courses in German and Dutch and French. He was quite good at communicating with people that way. When I was about 12, he got the idea that I and my siblings should all learn a new language. Most of us had been already learning Hebrew in school, but he thought something else to broaden our horizons. So the first language he picked was Russian for a brother of mine, and he kind of tossed him a Berlitz phrase book and said, here, go learn Russian. And wouldn't you know, he did. He still uses it all these years later in his work as a patent agent. That left the rest of us. He never threw any other books at us, but I was looking, if I figured if my brother could do it, so can I. I looked on the bookshelf, and what I found was a little green Burles travel book for Italian. And I thought to myself, I don't know if I would have picked this first choice, but that's what there is. Let me open it up and look. And it didn't take me long to figure out that not only is Italian a fairly easy language to learn, but it's also a very beautiful language. And I plunged into it. The next part of the story has to do with my grandmother, my mother's mother, who back in the 1920s had gone to Barnard College and, among other things, had studied Italian. When she found out what I was doing, first she gave me one of her old textbooks, which was very useful, and then she changed my life entirely. She showed me a book from her father's library. Her father had been a fairly prominent rabbi in New York in the early 20th century, and this book was the first volume of Samuel David Luzzatto's commentary on the Pentateuch. It was the Genesis volume. And she thought at first that I would just sort of be interested in looking at familiar biblical verses and see what they look like in Italian. And that was very entertaining. But then I noticed that not only were there the Italian translation of the text, but on the bottom of each page was, in Hebrew, a commentary. And when I started to look at that commentary, I realized this stuff makes sense. I like it. It's beautifully written, and it's good. Years passed. I was in law school. I was on a summer break. An idea popped into my head. I said, I've been looking at this for years. I have an unusual skill set. I know Hebrew. I know Italian. I have a feeling that very few people know about this wonderful material. Maybe what I should do is translate all of it into English, from the Italian and from the Hebrew. And I set out to do that. That was in 1976. It's been 40, 40, 45, whatever years. And on and off, I've been working on it, not steadily. It's never been my day job. But I published the first volume, Genesis, in 1998. A second edition came out just a couple of years ago because it needed a little bit of updating. It took another 15 years or so for Exodus to be ready. And then Leviticus just came out earlier this year. I'm hoping now that I'm getting older, I need to work a little faster to finish the Pentateuch before it's too long. I'm working on Book of Numbers now. I'm about a third of the way through. And that's the story.
We are talking today about Shadal's commentary on the Torah, the first three books, Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus. Would you give us first a sketch of Samuel David Luzzatto and why his commentaries are so significant?
Samuel David Luzzatto, Samuel Davide Luzzatto, known as Shadal, an acronym of his Hebrew name, lived from 1800 to 1865. I always tell people he was almost exactly a contemporary of Abraham Lincoln, to give you perspective there. He was born in Trieste, which is now in Italy, but was then part of the Austrian Empire. He spent most of his career in Padua, or Padova, also now in Italy, but also then part of the Austrian Empire. So you could say he was as Austrian as he was Italian. He was culturally Italian. The Italian language was his native tongue. And he spent most of his life teaching at a school in Padua called the Collegio Rabbinico, the Rabbinical College. It was really the first rabbinical seminary of its type, perhaps in the whole world. It was a professional training school for rabbis of the kind that had not existed before. In this role, he taught primarily Bible interpretation, also taught elements of the Jewish religion, elements of Jewish history, but his focus was always on interpretation, exegesis. Over the years, he was there about 35 years, and he was the mentor to many of the leading Italian rabbis who followed him. Some of them lived well into the 20th century. The longest surviving ones really lived into World War I, carrying on his legacy. He wrote many, many books. He was a poet. He was a thinker. He didn't like philosophy. I wouldn't call him a philosopher. I call him a thinker. He wrote books about grammar. He was very attuned to Hebrew grammar or grammar of any language. He taught himself several ancient and modern languages, French, German, Latin. He never attended university. He actually had very little formal education. When he was 13, he became ill, and his doctor decided he shouldn't be in school anymore, and that was the end of his formal education. but he studied with his father, who was also a scholar in his own right. He studied with chief rabbi at his native city. He kept up his studies and was a voracious reader on his own. He taught himself the science of grammar and read many Western philosophers. He became quite learned. You would never know that he was not a university product. In his career, he was a friend of many of the modern Jewish European scholars who were part of a movement known as Wissenschaft des Judentums, the academic study of Jewish texts and Jewish history. He accused some of them of not going about it for the right motives. He thought, well, they're just in it because they're interested in the ancient Judaic tradition, just as they would have been the ancient Egypt or ancient Babylonia, not as a living tradition, as he felt was his own interest. So he had a foot in both worlds. He was in the academic world, he was in the traditional Jewish world, and in that way he was really quite a unique figure. The reason I think he is significant to this day is because of this blend of ancient and modern that he embodies in his work. Those people who are from a more traditional background as far as Bible goes will appreciate his basic orientation, but people who are slightly more academic or modern bent can also glean from what his approach was. He very much believed in finding the truth where he found it, or where it could be found, accepting the truth where it could be found. He looked at all the sources he could find, ancient and modern, Jewish, non-Jewish. If there was anything of value, he would incorporate it. If found things in these sources that he disagreed with, he was very frank in his disagreement. But he didn't shut anything out of his intellectual universe. And that's what I admire about him. That's why I think he's relevant.
Translators who work so closely with a person's thought often get to know authors better than scholars who merely study their work without translating it. What would you say, after all these years, impresses you the most about Shadal?
I think he must have been a very interesting person. Maybe not always easy to get along with. He was very frank and sometimes sarcastic, and it comes through in his commentary. When he disagreed with somebody, he didn't suffer fools gladly. But besides his overall approach, his writing style is wonderful. An Italian observer once called it limpidissimo, very clear. And I think the combination of what he was saying and how he said it is very attractive, at least to me, and hopefully to an audience. I want to add something that hardly anybody knows about him. I discovered this only recently reading through some of his letters, which when you say letters, there are volumes of collections of his letters. There are two volumes of his letters in Hebrew alone. There is another volume of his letters in Italian, French, and Latin. I don't really read Latin. I haven't gotten into those. Somebody should. But the Italian letters, some of them are quite fascinating. And what comes out from some of these letters is that he had a very unusual friendship and a close friendship with a leading Catholic theologian of his day, Monsignor Francesco Nardi, who was a professor of canon law at the University of Padua when Shadal was teaching at the rabbinical seminary in Padua. I'm not sure how they met, but over a series of many years, they had an exchange of letters. Nardi was writing a book about the history of embroidery. I'm not sure how he got into that, but somehow he asked Shadal for biblical references to embroidery. It comes through in the building of the tabernacle. He provided those references, and Nardi thanked him, and in his book referred to Shadal as an ornament of our city, which I think was a little bit unusual for a Catholic clergyman to be referring to a Jewish person at that time. The relations between the church and the Jewish community were not always the best then. They went on to serve, and I would love to know more about this. They served together on a committee that was called upon to investigate an ancient tablet that had been found in Sicily and supposedly contained ancient Hebrew writing. I would love to know what the result of their research was and how they cooperated. I'm not sure if there's any more to find out about that, but just a tantalizing hint. Nardi wrote a book about the Catholic religion. Shadal felt confident enough in their friendship to express disagreement with some of the points that he made, but always referred to him in his letters as my dearest friend. It's a wonderful little sidelight on him that hardly anybody knows about. Well, now more people know.
Thinking about your translation of Shadal's commentary on Genesis, Maybe you can offer us an example passage that exemplifies his style or his insight.
Okay. Looking at Genesis, there's many gems and insights throughout his commentary on Genesis, but I think the very first remark he makes is probably the most significant one. He says, wise people know that the Torah, the Pentateuch, is not a book of science. That's not what it's for. That's not what it's teaching us. We shouldn't expect to find science in the Torah. He goes on to say, because of this, scholars of the Torah should not force the text of the Torah to conform with science. And on the other side of the coin, critics of the Bible should not reject the Torah if it does not conform with science. And these, I think, are lessons that still need to be learned today. There are people who, in this day, are trying to create a science out of what they find in the Torah. There are people who reject the Torah because it is not modern enough. All of these questions, I think, were irrelevant for Shaddai. He said, that's not what we're getting out of the Torah. The Torah is telling us how to live our lives. It's not pitched to intellectuals, it's pitched to the entire people. It's to better our lives and to teach us how to live with other people. As an example, say this is something that might cause a little concern or shock in some audiences. When he gets to the creation of the sun on the fourth day, he says, why is the sun's creation presented as happening on the fourth day? Wouldn't it have been sensible to have it done on the first day when there was light? And his answer is, many people worshiped the sun. Maybe what the Torah is trying to convey is, no, the sun is not the be-all and end-all. It wasn't what came first. It's a kind of a Johnny-come-lately in the course of creation, and it's being put in its place. Now, you can read into that what you want to read. And what I think he's saying is that the story of creation as told in Genesis is not necessarily a literal account. It took me a while to realize that that's what I think is what he's saying. Again, some people may find this too modern, some people may find it not modern enough. Whatever his approach was, I think it's very interesting, and this is one of the highlights, I think, of his commentary on Genesis.
Did any particular passage in Exodus, Shaddai's commentary on Exodus, stand out to you during your translation work as being especially significant, illumining, or winsome?
Yes, there is what there is that I would call winsome. When he gets down into the interpretation of words and phrases, which is mostly what he does. I mean, his first commentary on Genesis is a little bit unusual for him because he gets into a broader picture and how you should think about the book as a whole. But what he mostly does is gets into words and phrases. I always say, if you want an inspiring talk about the weekly reading of the Torah, you may not find it there. You may, but you may not. But if you want to know what this word means or that word means, Shaddai is your man. What I like especially about his commentary on Exodus is the way he treats the Song of the Sea, chapter 15. He talks about parallelism, biblical poetry, how words that seem to be Aramaic get into Hebrew poetry because they were archaic words of the kind that poets like to use. In particular, he zeroes in on one word in chapter 15, verse 5. In English, the first part of the verse is, the depths cover them. In Hebrew, it's Tehomot Yechasyumu. The word Yechasyumu, Shaddai points out, is a very odd and unusual word grammatically. He says it should have been something else a little bit. It should have sounded a little bit different. It should have been Yechasumo or Yechasum or Yechasyumo. But why two U sounds? That's very unusual. And he dismisses several other attempts at understanding why this unusual grammatic form occurs. His theory is that it's onomatopoeia. The word Yechasyumu sounds like you're getting into a dark and deep place in the sea. The Egyptians are drowning. They can't get out. Yechasyumu. And that really appeals to me a lot because he was attuned to the sound of the language and a unusual grammatical forms and why that was. I dropped a little footnote there. That's one of the things I enjoy about doing my translating work, is the ability to drop footnotes and explain things that he left unsaid, or add things that he never would have thought about. And in this case, I said, in the English language, you still have the same phenomenon with the double oo sound. You have an expression like doom and gloom, exactly the same thing. And then I remember reading a poem by Edgar Allan Poe called Ulalum, and it's the same idea. So I can understand what he's talking about. And that particular gem is what stands out in my mind for the Book of Exodus. Of course, there's much more there.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Most recently, you've also translated Shadal's commentary on Leviticus, which of itself is already a difficult book. It has technical, cultic terms. In your preface to that work, though, you mentioned being surprised at how much you enjoy translating Luzzatto's commentary on Leviticus. How so?
Okay, well, the first thing I mentioned in my introduction is I found a really good quote from Mary Douglas, who said that Leviticus is usually looked upon as a book that's put away in a glass case. It can be admired, it can be thought about, but it's a little bit inaccessible. So the fun, if you will, of translating Leviticus was making it more accessible. I certainly made it more accessible to myself. I also mentioned in my introduction that my daughter was preparing a series of lectures about the book of Leviticus, and in the course of doing that, came to the realization that in many years of Jewish education, she had never studied it in school. And then I thought, I really didn't either. I mean, very briefly, we touched upon some of it at Yeshiva University, but most people never actually sit down and study it, at least as part of a Jewish education. So I became much more familiar with what was going on. Anytime you translate anything, you become familiar. And here's a cute little sidelight. I have a friend whose cousin once translated the Book of Jonah into Klingon. And when I heard about that, I thought, you know, what could be a bigger waste of time than that? And then I thought about it some more, and I said, he knows the Book of Jonah better than anybody. So the enjoyment I had besides that in translating Leviticus was what we call in the legal publishing industry, adding value. You don't just repeat what a court said. You interpret it, you compare it with other court cases. And so I feel like I've added value. When we come to the laws of the so-called leprosy disease, it's tzarat in Hebrew. It's quite apparent that this is not the disease called leprosy in modern times, or Hansen's disease. And I did a little research about why the disease was called leprosy. Shadal himself translates it in his Italian as lebra, which means leprosy. That was a conventional way to translate the word in his day. In some translations, it still does appear that way. But I wanted to find out why that misconception came about. Apparently, there were two different diseases. There was one in the ancient times. There was one that was known to the Greek-speaking scholars later. Were familiar with something called leprosy and figured, well, this must be the same thing. This has some overlap of symptoms. But apparently, it was a misconception. So I dropped a very long footnote about, you know, why Shadal used the word lebra. In my research, I discovered other writings of his in Italian about going into more detail and explaining that he didn't really think it was a contagious disease. He didn't really think it was something that could be treated medically. So I found out a little bit more about what he thought besides what he wrote in his actual commentary. And I found out a lot about those diseases, and that was enjoyable to me. I'd never known these things before, and hopefully it will be edifying for readers. Another instance where he doesn't say a lot in his actual commentary, but I dug up a little more information, was his discussion of what we now call Rosh Hashanah, the New Year. In Hebrew, in the text, it's called Yom HaZikaron, the Day of Proclamation. And the proclamation is made by sounding the shofar. He doesn't say much about the significance of the shofar, but I found in his letters a much more extensive discussion. One of his pen pals, as you may call it, was a rabbi named Elia ben Amozeg, an Italian rabbi of Moroccan origin, who was very much into mysticism and Kabbalah. And he said in one of his letters to Shadal, obviously written right before Rosh Hashanah, he said, "Tomorrow you will hear the shofar, and I will hear it. I know what it will say to me. It'll have all sorts of mystic reasons to be listening to it, but what will it say to you?" And Shadal replied, "It will say to me, first of all, you should know that I think the reason that we blow the shofar is simply because in ancient times there were no printed calendars, and this was a way to let everybody know that the new year was coming. Now that that purpose is no longer around, we still sound the shofar to remind us of us being the Jewish people, of our national past, our political past, and the pride we should be taking in those remembrances." Then he goes on to say, "Actually, bottom line, the real reason we blow the shofar is because God told us to. We don't need any more reason than that." And Ben Amozeg was really not satisfied with that. He said, the shofar could be looked upon as an ancient, irrelevant relic if all it is for calendar purposes or to remind us of the past. That's not going to grab people today. It's not going to get them interested in hearing the shofar being blown. Interesting enough, he sort of anticipated something that happened in part of the Reform Jewish movement. They found the shofar embarrassingly archaic and substituted a trumpet or a trumpet sound of an organ. This is an attitude that did exist. Ben Amozeg's answer to all of that was, well, you have to really attune yourself to what is happening in the supernal world when you blow the shofar. He never exactly explained to Shadal what he thought that meant, but I find this a very interesting sidelight, which is not found in the commentary itself. I had to dig, and I added a footnote, and that's one of part of the enjoyment I found in translating Leviticus.
And you mentioned earlier that you're about a third of the way through in your translation work on Numbers?
Yes. I've had to put it on a little bit of hold because of things like this that came up. I had to prepare for that. But once I get back to it, I will be trying to put on a head of steam. And again, it's the same kind of thing. His commentary on Genesis was probably about twice as long as any of the other books. Certainly in Leviticus, and I think in the rest of the books, we'll leave several verses at a time uncommented. But just translating his translation is a way of finding out what he thought about the meaning of certain words, especially because in his translation, which was originally published separately, I should point out how this happened. He published his Italian translation of the text separately, and before he died, 1858 or so, 1858 to 1860, his Hebrew language commentary was never really meant for a large audience. He published short excerpts from it in the 1840s, probably wanted to publish more of it, but died before he could do that. So what happened was he never actually prepared an entire manuscript himself that we know about. He left probably manuscripts of his in his own writing. I'm not sure. I've seen these manuscripts. No one's quite sure who wrote them, whether he or some of his students. But what we do know is that some of his students did take very careful notes in class, or even perhaps were given material to see before class, wrote them down, and these students compiled what they had and prepared for publication a combined edition of Shaddal's Italian translation and his Hebrew commentary. So they were never actually meant to be together, but they were in the end, starting in the 1870s. There sometimes actually are contradictions between the text translation and the commentary, because he never really was there to put a final editing job on the whole thing. Also, during the course of his career, we know that he fairly frequently changed his opinions. So he didn't always have time to catch his translation up or catch his commentary up to make it conform with each other. That's, again, part of the fun. When I find a contradiction, the first thing I have to do is ask myself, am I translating this correctly? Is this right? And then when I'm sure about that, I'll try to account for the difference. I actually wrote a whole article once, going back to Genesis, where Abraham, still known as Abram at the time, is promised by God that he will have many descendants. And the verse, I don't have it in front of me right now, it's he had faith in the Lord and he counted it as righteousness. Who's the he? Who's counting righteousness to whom? And this, I was quite surprised to see that the translation by Shaddal went one way, that God was according righteousness to Abram. In his translation, he said, absolutely not. As if he hadn't even ever seen his own translation. He said, it's the other way. Abram is attributing righteousness to God. And here's why. He goes on and on. This really bothered me for a while because, you know, am I seeing things? What's going on? Then I discovered a letter that he had written to a Hebrew periodical explaining his change of thought. And it's too long to get into here, but he did change his thought, and he had several reasons for doing that, and this is one of the fascinations about translating Shaddal. One more thing, in the Book of Numbers, it begins kind of prosaically. There are a lot of census figures and names and numbers, hence the Book of Numbers, but what I haven't gotten to yet, and what I can't wait to, is the story of, in Hebrew, Bilam, and in English would be Balaam. He has a series of questions. What made him tick? What was he up to? Was he a real prophet? Was he a false prophet? Did he worship God? Did he not worship God? Just very briefly, his idea was that he worshiped God because that was his assignment for that day. He was a prophet for hire. He would look into whatever any cult demanded or was asked of to worship their God and get into that. And his thought was, by so doing, he would be able to manipulate God into doing what he was asked to do, bless or curse accordingly. What it reminds me of, and I'll probably drop a footnote to this, is that when you watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, the same thing happens toward the end. You have the evil French archaeologist who's been asked to open up the Ark, and he first gets himself up to look like a high priest, and his Nazi handlers are asking him, why all this Jewish stuff? He says, oh, we have to do it this way. This is exactly what Balaam, I think, was trying to do. He brought sacrifices, he built altars, thinking that he could, in that way, accomplish, winding God around his finger. Of course, it didn't work for him, it didn't work for the French archaeologist, but they tried. And I think that's what was going on at that time.
Hopefully we can have you back on the NBN to talk more about Numbers when you're done.
I would like nothing more.
So what does life look like after translating Shaddal on the Torah?
The next thing I want to do, I could easily spend decades more translating his works. He unfortunately died at the age of 65. I'm older than that now, and to catch up with all of his work take many, many more years. The next project I would like to try to tackle is his commentary on Isaiah, which is considered by many his masterwork. It's this very voluminous, it's a wonderful piece of work, and it would take years and years to work on, but I'd like to at least get my teeth into it at some point. So that's my vision for the future.
Dan, it's been a tremendous delight speaking with you about your translation work on Shaddal's commentaries. Thank you so much for being generous with your time.
It was entirely my pleasure.
All right, friends, you've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.